This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Marty O'Donnell, and it is always so fantastic to talk with you.
It's fantastic to talk with you, Kate. I'm really glad you called again, and we can have this conversation. And there's snow on the ground, thank you. Somehow you're always the harbinger of snow in Seattle.
Must be my Chicago or Wisconsin vibe something. But yeah, I have been really looking forward to talking with you because the very first time we talked, it was right at the end, the home stretch of the Kickstarter that you were doing to raise the funds to create a prequel album for the game that would become Golem, which was released in November. And I can't believe that was almost 4 years ago.
Ugh, that's just... Don't remind me.
So it's been so much fun to hear that music and learn where it all fit in the game. So I guess, gosh, I don't know where to start. maybe we could talk a little bit about the story so
sure.
that when we talk about the music, it has some context. Because you weren't able to do that before.
That's true.
The game is out. The story follows the youngest daughter of a family of, I guess, what? They're basically scavengers looking for treasures on the very edges of this abandoned, ruined city. And the mother has passed away, and the older daughter, it turns out, has this secret way of getting into the city and finding all of the treasures. And she passes that on to the littlest daughter. And so the story itself is just so interesting. And so I'm wondering, you knew all this probably before you started writing the prequel music. And
you know, it's so long ago, I can't remember exactly what I knew and what I didn't know. One thing that's interesting to me is that, of course, it's a fantasy, and we knew that. And we knew that it was going to be basically set in a, you know, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. So we don't know. It's not necessarily any place on Earth, but it has feelings of sort of a desert community, Middle East kind of place. The other interesting thing, I'm pretty sure I knew the general story. I don't think we had completely finished writing the script yet, but we knew who the characters were and what the story was, the story arc. So, but it's interesting to hear you keep saying the youngest daughter, because we don't ever make it explicit if it's a daughter or a son. Twine is whatever you want Twine to be, so...
Wow, that is interesting. I just sort of projected that.
Yeah, which is great, which is exactly yeah. what we want, yeah.
Well, what's so interesting, too, is eventually Twine learns how to control first a doll that allows him or her to...
you don't have to keep saying that. You can go ahead and say okay. her. It's fine with me.
To get to a workshop where there are these bits and pieces of not only treasures, but also the golems that are in this endless city, these incredibly huge armored beings, mechanical beings. And, you know, learning more about this city and as the game develops and everything, how much did the game influence your music as you were working on it, once the prequel music was all basically finished and published?
Well, I knew the story arc, like I said, and I knew there was going to be a lot of fighting with these huge golems, but I just didn't feel like I needed to spend a lot of time on writing what we might traditionally call battle music for when you're fighting golems. What I really wanted to try to establish with the Kickstarter and with the music was some sort of thematic elements that reflected fantasy, childhood, imagination, and exploration. So I really just sort of stayed in there, along with this sort of concept of lullaby melody that was sung to these kids by their mother. And perhaps the lullaby itself, or that melody, had some sort of magical power to it. I didn't know for sure that we were going to actually use it in the game until after I'd finished the prequel album. And then Jamie, the creative director, who he and I worked, you know, he was the main writer, of course, behind the story and the script and the design. But he was like, well, let's have whoever we get to play Sky, let's have her sing this melody. So that was something that was done after the music was written. And it was really great that when we were casting for Skye, the older sister, we had to find an actress who could do everything we wanted and be able to sing this melody. And we found Dana Davis, an actress from, she's done a lot of TV in out of Los Angeles. And she was really amazing. And as soon as I sang her the melody, she sang it right back to me in this beautiful voice. And it was just, it's like, okay, well, that's the one. Plus she could throw. She was a left-handed thrower, and we needed a shot because she came up for a performance capture, and we needed her to be able to throw a bunch of acorns into the barrier. And as soon as she threw, it was just like, that's perfect. She threw just like she was, a fastball pitcher. It was great. So she hit it. She really hit everything we needed.
Well, what I really loved, that melody, that lullaby melody, we talked about it in our earlier conversations about the album, and it was just so wonderful to finally hear it in the context of the game. And it's not even like a huge moment. It's almost like a incidental, they're remembering their mother, and then Skye just comes out with it. And yet it's a thread that runs through the whole soundtrack and all these really special moments in the game too. So yeah, they really knocked it out of the park with that theme. I mean, it's just...
Thanks. it was great to be able to incorporate some sort of melodic thing into a game that's not a music game, but actually a story-driven game. That was a lot of fun.
Well, it must have been an interesting process because this isn't like any kind of game you've worked on before. It's not like Myth or Halo or Destiny. And so what were some of the things that you thought about that you wanted the music to do, or maybe a different role that you thought the music would have?
Yeah, it was sort of a struggle, especially at first. This is a very, very different game than any of us have made before. Number one, it's VR. And so we know that the player is always inhabiting some sort of character, but in this virtual reality space. And then there's this extra layer of them, being a twine sitting in a bed with not being able to move, but being able to magically control dolls or golems that are huge. And so we had this sort of like interesting mechanic that we had to work with and concept of the player actually controlling these golems. And then it was like, oh yeah, let's make this a completely wide open world game with no scripted moments really when you get into it. It's like you can go in any direction, you can look any place, you can explore as long as you want any place. And it was just like, oh yeah, that's really cool. Until you start thinking about, okay, now how do I make music for this exactly? How do I implement the music in an open world game? And really, all the Halos, Destiny, Myth, every game I've worked on so far, to the extent that it has open world gameplay, it also has scripted moments. And scripted moments are much easier to think about for music because you at least know this thing is going to happen when the player does X, and then it's going to go through a sequence of events, and maybe they're variable in time, but at least you know what these events are going to be. With a open world game, you just don't know what the player is going to do, so you have to accommodate for all of that. So that was the biggest hurdle for me as a composer and someone who had to implement music. I had to think about all the possibilities and then all the ways that I could try to score those things or fail to score those things. So there was a lot of playing on my part. Once we got it, once the game was up on its feet and the design started coming together and we could actually play through the game, that's when I discovered what music was needed and what I needed to do to make it come alive musically.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I really want to talk to you about, because the additional music that you wrote is just so perfect with the sound design. And as you're controlling the golem in this amazing ruined city and you come upon another one, you've got to fight them. And you created these amazing drum tracks that just really amplify the epic scale of the golems. And so did you work with a live drummer to create those?
Yeah, me.
Oh.
Yeah, and you know, as audio director, and this is something I'm always, I'm so happy that when I get to work on a project, I mean, the only projects I've ever worked on, I'm also audio director, so I'm in charge of how all the audio comes together and is created. And so I had one other guy, Ian Shores, who was just tremendous. He was my sound design lead. Well, he's the only other guy on the audio team. And so he and I worked hand in glove. We were together every day. And so whatever was happening from the sound design standpoint, I was always incorporating that. And then I knew that there would be times where the battle would have so much sound in terms of swords clanking and rocks being hit and, you know, all of this sound that, like, I just needed something to ramp up the intensity for those moments. And once I came upon sort of this cool sort of primitive drum sound, I just didn't want to sweeten it with a bunch of other sort of percussion. I just wanted it was like almost a primitive feel for the drums that always, sort of like Jaws, you know, it's like,
yeah.
It's like you knew that you were fighting a stone golem when those drums started happening. But the other thing, of course, is I didn't want it to happen every time you fight a golem, because then that gets really predictable. So I threw some other stuff and other ways of fighting, other sort of battle music, or sometimes no battle music at all. It just let the sound design carry the day.
Yeah, and that's such an interesting idea to just not have battle music, because it's such a, you know, a video game meme. If you're fighting a bad guy, of course there's music, but
right.
It's really interesting to not have any. And the other thing that really struck me in some of the battles, because of the sound design of the golems and their heavy armor, and when they whack them and they drop to their knees, that makes a sound. You created these cues that incorporate a lot of that, sounds like same sort of metallic sounds, banging
right.
metal sounds. And mm-hmm. It's such a great fit. It's just really cool.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and it was fun to see it sort of come together, you know, and also there was, we only had intensity ramping one way. I had the ability to turn down intensity if I needed to musically, but it was like, especially during the battles, the closer you got to your own death or to the death of a golem that you're fighting, the music would ramp up in intensity. And then it was always some sort of climactic final ending to that piece when death occurs. So it wasn't like we had death music, like you didn't have your own music that plays every time you die, which is another meme that I actually really dislike. But there was always something that made you realize, okay, it's finished. It's over. And now we're going to we're transitioning to something else.
I should mention, you put 4 playthroughs, the complete playthrough of of the game, on YouTube, and it's been really interesting to watch that. And so for anybody who doesn't have a PlayStation VR setup, you can still watch Marty play the game, which is really cool. You're really good.
Thanks. And I'm playing it in a way that it's just one possible, you know, pathway through the game. And there's tons of things that are not in my playthrough. We have all sorts of other, I wouldn't call them side quests, but I would call it, you could explore other areas and open other doors and find other things. So even after I'm supposedly done with the game, I've killed the final bad guy, and whatever has happened happens. I don't want to spoil it now that I think about it. You continue to explore the city if you want. So I put a little extra, here's a place you can explore. And oh, by the way, look, you can open this door and become a doll again and find new stuff, and more parts of the story are exposed to you with, you know, hearing your mother's voice. And I don't think I even did possibly 30% of what you could find when you explore the city. So there's quite a lot of content in there if you're willing to go find it. And of course, if you find everything, you get a nice little award. Reward.
That's so cool. Yeah. What I loved about watching it is it's like somebody showing you around a house they've built and pointing out, you know, all the cool things that they really want you to notice. And
yeah, you know, it's funny. I like to play the game as though I'm playing it for the first time. But of course, you know, I know where everything is and where to go. So, but I still want to make people feel like if they were playing and they sort of looked to the right and saw something interesting, maybe they would go explore it. So I try to make it feel like it's the first time for me, but of course it's not. I've never done a playthrough like this on any game I've made, basically because I want everybody to go buy the game and everybody already has the machine that they need. In this case, the PSVR is a very niche-y, unique little thing, and I'm not sure if Sony would be happy I just said that, but anyway, it doesn't have as deep a penetration as the Xbox or the PlayStation, of course. So I thought, well, at least people can see it and maybe they'll be intrigued enough to go and get a setup so they can play the game.
Yeah. Well, in the time that it's taken for the game to get, you know, from start to finish, I imagine VR has kind of evolved a bit too. So were there any decisions or any things that you had to rethink to get everything to fit and work the way you wanted it to?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. You know, we stayed somewhat insular in terms of what we thought was important about VR. And I'm really happy with the design choices that were made and how we made them. And I love playing it the way I show it in the walkthrough. But it's true, the other games came out in the meantime, and it's especially in VR, and I don't think this has been decided yet. So no matter what anybody in VR says, and we were aware of every possible way of moving physically through an environment in VR. We experimented and looked at all of different ways of doing that. I think some people, because so much time had passed, if we had come out 2 years ago, it's possible people would have been a little more interested in the sort of experimental way that we were allowing you to move through our environments, because no other game has you move the way we have you move. So unfortunately, with an extra 2 years of people getting into habits of saying this must be the right way to move through environments, there was a little bit of a hiccup there at the beginning where people were like, why can't I move the same way I moved in all these other games or in this one other game, or where is this one controller that I bought for this other thing that I'm used to? So we had to sort of respond to that pretty quickly and come up with a patch so that people could also move the way that they were used to, even though I personally think that our movement scheme is the best and everybody should just get used to it. You know, it's funny because, you know, everybody in the press, and you hear this all the time, it's like, why aren't games more experimental? Why aren't people experimenting? What happened to people experimenting? And trust me, it's like, well, we really took a flyer on a lot of things. And it seems like people are like, why is this so experimental? Why did you do that? Why isn't it like I'm used to? So and that's not everybody. We have a lot of people who go like, oh my goodness, this is such a cool way to move and explore. Like, I'm surprised nobody else has done this. But it is hard to do something that nobody else has done and get immediate applause.
Well, again, though, it just like really points out that, you know, VR is still sort of the Wild West or the wild frontier of gaming right now, because there are no rules.
Yeah. I mean, in 4 years ago when you and I were talking, I think there was this sort of like, oh, VR is just around the corner and it's going to be a giant new thing and everybody's going to jump on the bandwagon. And I mean, all you have to do is look at the way things happened. It hasn't happened that way. VR is still very much in my opinion, still in the first generation experimental stage. And so everybody should be experimenting. Everybody should be trying different things and hoping that we get enough buy-in from the public that they can get to generation two on VR. And I think that's going to happen. I just think it's going to be a lot slower adoption than we were hoping like 4 years ago.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, it gives you time to sort of, you know, test the waters and still continue to try out different things as, you know, movements evolve and that kind of thing. So in a way, I guess it's really great that it's not all like cast in stone yet.
Yeah, so. No, it's very much Wild West, like you said, and that's really fun. We're sort of taking a break from VR right now. So we're working on another project that is not going to be VR at this moment. But I would love to go back to VR at some point, because I've never worked on something that when you have the headphones on and the headset, that you are as deeply immersed especially the audio environment. Everything is completely around you and it makes sense. It's not like you're sitting in front of your TV with speakers in the rear, but you're always just looking forward. You're looking at the 2D screen in front of you, and there's sort of a fakeness to the fact that you're hearing sounds behind you. And this even happens to me in movie theaters. No matter how big a screen you have, when I hear sounds behind me in the movie theater, sometimes I'm like, did somebody just drop something? And I look behind, you know, I'm like, oh, no, oh, yeah, that's supposed to be happening in the movie. And as soon as your mind goes there, you've broken the fourth wall. And that's always been a problem for me with what I call 2D screens now. It's still very effective and it's still fun to work there, but HRTF and 360-degree sound that completely makes sense because you're moving your head around in that environment. When something seems like it's happening behind you in your headphones, you don't think something's happening behind you in the real world. You think you are in the real world. And that's really, really cool. And then getting music to also enhance that stuff and mixing it, I think it's just a wonderful experience. And I hope I get to do more work there in the future.
Yeah. Well, I love how you covered the empty spaces in The Endless City with not melodic music, but there's definitely kind of an ambient background music. It's very low key. And what I love about it is that it gives the other natural sounds that you've put in that landscape a chance to shine too. It's kind of like, you know, when you open up a Halo map and you turn everything off and you can just listen to the sounds and stuff. So yeah. It must have been really fun to put that whole sound world together.
Yeah, and that's the other advantage of being the audio director is that I can have diegetic music. So that's music that's supposedly happening in the environment itself, coming from the environment. So like we have some urns and these other little things called echoes scattered throughout the cities that has its own sort of musical sounds to it. And in the catacombs, these urns sound like a choir of people singing. And they actually are coming inside the environment itself, which of course really mixes nicely with whatever ambient sound we have. And then there are other times when the ambient sound, all I'm doing is creating some ambient music that's just a little bit more, adds a little more creepiness to the whole thing. So you're not necessarily sure where the ambient starts and where the music, you know, begins or ends or whatever. And that's really fun to be able to play with all those elements.
Thank you.
it's neat because then, yeah, it sort of blurs the line between the sound design and the music. And I think it just makes the world seem really alive. And so did you go out and record your own sounds for all of this?
Yeah, some of it is our own sounds. You know, Ian went out and recorded things and came back and made some stuff. And then I would, you know, I would ask for different things or we'd work on that together. Yeah, so some of it is, you know, just sound design that we're recombining from found sounds or recorded sounds or sound libraries. But nothing is, there's no straight up sound library stuff. So
yeah. Well, yeah. Who got to do the swords? The swords are great.
Ian did the swords, yeah, and he worked on that a long time. He also did a lot of the screaming of different golem voices, and he added his own. There was a time when I was like, okay, this is really good. We'll need more of that. You know, here's what I want you to do. And he goes, well, I got to take a little break. I really wrecked my voice last time.
Oh, no.
So I'm like, oh, I didn't know you were screaming. So that was cool.
Yeah, I bet.
Especially the clay golems, the ones that look like skeletons. That was a lot of screamy sounds that he had to do.
Oh, man. Well, hopefully he went through a lot of, like, I don't know, throat lozenges and honey and stuff.
Well, that's what you know, when he's a young kid, right? So he's in his 20s still. So I'm going to make sure that the youngsters do that kind of work.
Yeah, yeah.
I did it at one point, but I don't feel like doing that anymore.
Oh, man. Well, what is so interesting, we've talked about this when we were chatting about your early ideas for the music of the spheres and how you write pieces that, you know, they tell a story. They have a beginning and a middle and an end. And you did that with the prequel music for this, The Echoes of the First Dreamer. And so what was the process like to sort of break up those complete tracks and figure out where you could put stems in and that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I tend to do things with different intentions. So like when I'm like, okay, I'm going to do a prequel album, and this means that I need to write pieces of music that stand on their own, are enjoyable and interesting to listen to from the beginning of whatever the piece is to the end. So yeah, obviously that has to be traditional kind of music in terms of that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I'm not while I'm doing that, I'm not necessarily thinking about how those things could be broken up. I'm just confident that they can be broken up because I've done it so many times. I know that there's always a way to break things up. But I did make sure, especially on Echoes of the First Dreamer, that I had recorded everything with live orchestra, which was, I think we talked about this, it was basically a sort of a chamber orchestra, very little, just horns were the only brass that I used, and then, you know, woodwinds, strings, and harp with piano. But I made sure that all of those different choirs were recorded so that I could have them cleanly separated, even though they were meant to go together. But I knew that I would have stems, and then I could separate all the stems out and then think about how would I reorder them or chop them up or make them into randomly generated new things or add new tracks to them so that I could make, you know, what I call adaptive music that can adapt to the way the player is playing. Every piece was easily stemmed. Not every piece had every section that found a home inside the game itself. So, but I'm still pretty happy with the amount of Echoes music that ended up being in the game and those themes coming through. So that was pretty interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think there's just a couple of them that I was listening to. I was listening to the album again, and I think there are really just a few that didn't make it into the game. And the other thing that I was wondering about, because in the performances for the tracks for the album, there's a lot of, you know, rubato. It's not necessarily strictly adhering to the metronome. And I know that that's a thing that you've been kind of pursuing or thinking about, is
yes,
having the music not necessarily be, you know, metronomic. And so how did you adapt it so that it would work in the game?
Yeah, I do get on my high horse about rubato. And the main reason is because in the history of music, rubato is so important. I mean, people's actual felt performances of music is essential, and it's not necessarily always written into the scores or the editorial markings, but it never isn't there in just about all classical music especially. So I don't think that it makes sense to have an entire genre like video games and video game music not have rubato. And it's the same way with movie scores. But traditional movie scores, the composers build in, their cues are linear, so they know from this point to this point what's going to happen on the screen. And if they want to put a retard in there, or a fermata, or some ebb and flow and breathing in the music, they plan for it and record it that way. If the music itself, like if I'm starting with music to begin with, and the music itself feels like it needs to slow down here or speed up there or breathe in a certain way, I let the music determine that primarily, or the conductor or the performers. Then, because I have it stemmed, you don't have to use a tool that says, oh, because this is starting at, you know, 115 beats per minute, it has to remain on that grid in order to have different chunks of the music triggered at different points. You can actually put it in with what we just call markers. And the markers don't have to be on any grid. They could just be like, on this phrase, this is a marker. And so play this phrase, and then when you get to this marker, depending on what the player does, you can go to one or two or three or four different other phrases. So you can have rubato within those phrases, and it works great, in my opinion.
That's so cool. Well, it makes the music seem really alive, and just kind of reinforces that it's being played by real people too.
Right.
So, yeah, for sure. Are there any plans for another soundtrack release to incorporate the music that you've written for Gollum?
You know, the plans are in my head. there's no, because it was a, you know, it, like if you remember, it was a Kickstarter campaign, yeah, that we did for Echoes, and that was very successful, and we were really happy with it. And now we're working on other things as a company, but I have the ability and access to make a soundtrack of the game itself. So all the other music that was written for the game, plus the music that it's, you know, from Echoes that I used in the game, could be Gollum the soundtrack. It's possible. I've been thinking about it. I know it's going to take some work on my part, which is why I'm thinking about it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, if I've had several people, you know, request that I do this, and I'm thinking about it. And so maybe if more people request it, I will do it. It would be fun to do, but it's still a lot of work.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah, they are a lot of work, and then you've got to find a distributor and that kind of thing. And
well, you know, it's interesting. Materia Collective, which is you probably know Sebastian.
Oh, sure. Yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah. I know that they would pick it up and run with it as soon as I give it to them. So we've talked about it. It's just up to me whether I do it or not. So they're... That's
wow.
what that is.
Yeah, in your spare time.
So. Yeah.
And I meant to mention this right off the bat when we started our conversation because it's just so cool. But you've been nominated for a DICE Award for Outstanding Achievement in Original Music Composition for Golem. And congratulations. That is just such a huge, huge accomplishment.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This is exactly, I know it's such a cliche to say it's an honor to be nominated, but it really is an honor to be nominated, especially for me in this category. Original music composition is a difficult thing to get nominated for in the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences. It's a very legit award because it's nominated by people from within the industry. It's voted on by people who are in the industry. So it really, really is an honor, and the group of people that are also nominated along with me are some amazing composers with some amazing products. So I'm thrilled.
Yeah, and I can't. I'm glad I don't have to decide.
I wish you could.
Oh well, yeah. That's true. I feel like I have to be a little impartial, you know. Being
yes, you do. Well, yeah. I mean, there's other people that you've interviewed that are also nominated, which I think is great.
Yeah, yeah. That's
and great. We're you know, it's funny to me. Like from the very beginning of my time in the game industry, the music and audio people have always been friends. We always get along. We go to conventions together. We have, you know, Brian Schmidt has the Game Sound Convention in LA every year, and I've got to speak there a few times and do the keynote and stuff. And every time you're there, it's just like, you know, old home week. You just feel like you're with a bunch of friends. So we all really support each other, and we're all happy to see each other nominated.
Yeah, that's been one of the most unexpectedly wonderful things of doing this series because, yeah, everybody that I talk with is friends with everybody else. And it just seems like such an amicable bunch. Nobody's like backstabbing each other to get a project. And
well,
so.
You know, it's another cliche. It's a small world, but in the world of people making a living at writing music for games, there's not a zillion of us. And it's in a sense, I think I might have even talked about this before, but if you think about the village and the village elders, and then there's the best storyteller in the village. Well, if you're like a storyteller in the village, but there's all you need is one. So anybody who's really good at storytelling kind of has to go find their own village. they have to move, which means there's like it's rare to rub shoulders, rub elbows with other composers because there's just not room enough in this town for the two of us. It's that kind of thing. It's not mean. It's just that like everybody has to find their own space. So when we come together at, you know, GDC or Game Sound Con or DICE or whatever, we immediately like, oh, hey, Austin, how you doing? Yeah, Marty, it's great to see you. So it's like, you know, we're not all working at the same company. You can only have like maybe one per company. And I've been lucky enough to make sure that every game I've worked on, I'm audio director, sound design, and composer. So, you know, I just have never hired other composers from the outside. Most of the other people who are in this category are, you know, freelancers, and they're doing several different projects for several different companies. And almost nobody gets to be as embedded as I do, depending on the size of the budget sometimes, which is funny. The lower the budget, probably the more embedded they get in the project. The bigger the budget, you'll have, you know, there's 10 composers on this giant budget thing, and they just get assigned what they have to write, and they just write it sort of in a vacuum. And I think that's kind of too bad. I wish the composers actually especially had more input into the implementation and the creative direction of the music as it applies to any given game. And I feel like the bigger the budget, sometimes the less input is required or asked for from the composers.
Well, I remember when we talked the very first time, you were really looking forward to working with this way smaller team at Highwire, mm-hmm. and how everybody was going to be responsible for many different aspects of the game. And did it turn out the way you hoped? I mean, did it end up being a great experience?
Yes and no. You know, with whatever, great power becomes great responsibility. So, you know, I'm full of cliches today, but it was funny. I mean, we knew this going in, and I knew this too, but like towards the end, I'm like, where's our test team? Where's our user experience people that are testing constantly and giving us feedback? You know, we had, I think there was less than 20 people who worked on this game. Our Highwire itself is right around 30, a little more than 30. And then we bulked up to this size because of the new project we're working on. But at the end of Golem, as the vast majority of the team was working on this other project, I went to Jamie and Jared, my two partners, and I'm like, who's in charge of testing this game? I'm playing it, and I'm finding all these problems, and we need to test. And they kind of looked at me like, you're it, buddy. So I basically became test manager, which is not my strong point, trust me. But I was able to get other people who had within the team who had never even worked on the game, who were excited about spending extra time to test the game. And we had other people who had experience with managing sort of test processes. So we had a schedule, and people played and tested and reported bugs, and we fixed it. And that whole closing process was very scary because, you know, we had a goal of finally shipping, obviously, but we had to make sure that it was bug-free. And I'm thankfully, other than the patch that we made so that people could have more options to how they control their character, we didn't have any crashing bugs that we shipped, at least up to this point. So I'm pretty happy with that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But that's definitely, when you say, yeah, I want to be in a smaller company where I get to have more control and wear more hats. Sometimes you're like, what? I'm wearing this hat? What is that? I don't want to do that.
Yeah, all other duties as assigned, I think, is what.
Yes.
Well, right around Christmas time, you posted a video with an Easter egg for the game.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. do you want to talk about that at all? Have you had any
It's funny. I put this Easter egg in the game, and of course, I'm kind of used to millions of players. So if you have, I mean, let's just put it where if you have a million players, any Easter egg you put in, there's going to be some little percentage of the players who find the Easter egg or look for Easter eggs or are dedicated to that. And I thought, once we released Golem, I realized, oh, you know, this is a really obscure Easter egg. And, you know, number one, we have a much smaller install base with PSVR. We have a much smaller, you know, number of people who actually are buying and playing Golem. And so I realized pretty quickly that, like, this Easter egg might never be noticed unless I tell people there's an Easter egg. So I did this thing, and it's what's even to this moment, nobody's actually figured out how to trigger this Easter egg. So I hope people will look for it who are playing the game. And if they're interested, the egg isn't what I did with the music while it's playing. It's the fact that I can trigger that music. It's the full piano lullaby from beginning to end. It's the full 3-minute version of that piece that plays if you do something in the game. You'll get that piece to play. And so that's what I was showing.
It's very cool. It's really fun to watch, especially when you link up and
yes,
it happens. It's just,
yes,
just really cool.
I sort of kept the beginning part dark, but I kept it dark so you didn't see the whatever the whatever I was doing to trigger it. But there's a lot of clues in that little video that should help people understand the kind of thing they need to do. And then the only thing I did, which I thought was fun, because I used to do it when I was testing to see that the Easter egg worked, was I would act like Twine was sitting in bed playing an air piano. So I thought, well, I'll shoot it that way. But you don't, that's not the Easter egg isn't Twine playing the piano. The Easter egg is the piano playing, and then you can do anything you want while that music's playing.
It's really cool. Well, we've covered a lot, but is there anything that I missed that you would like people to know about the process or how you put the music in the game?
Well, the only thing I hope people would do is, if they're intrigued at all by this game, is just be patient with it. Like, you know, I know it's a sort of like you have to have a PlayStation 4, you have to have a PSVR, you have to set the whole thing up, you have to make sure that your system is calibrated correctly, otherwise you will not have a very good experience. But once you get all that stuff working, be patient with the control scheme that we're giving you, because I feel, my personal opinion is that if you play it the way we design it, which is what we call lean to move, and when you want to move, you just lean slightly. And the biggest problem I've seen with people playing our game is they lean way too far, or they keep leaning forward more and more and more. Whereas all you have to do is be in a comfortable upright position, and you should be seated. That's essential. It's a game that you play while you're sitting.
Yeah.
You shouldn't play it while you're standing up, because all the proportions are wrong. So you should be seated, and when you lean, it's almost all you have to do is just kind of relax a little bit, and your body just goes forward just enough to make you move. And the game knows that you want to move because you're holding the trigger down. As soon as you release the trigger, you're no longer moving. And the other thing is that we also judge what direction you want to move in by where you're looking. And people don't understand that if they want to strafe, they can strafe. That's why we give you this whole opening where you can walk around the room and experiment as a doll, as we were hoping people would spend the time to go, oh, I see how this works. This is really, it's unusual, and possibly even feels like it might be uncomfortable at first, but within a few minutes, you should get pretty good at it and get used to it. So the people who have bothered to do, I guess it's kind of like work, but if they've bothered to do that, they have a much better experience than immediately wanting to use their thumbs to move around. There's this habit in most video games where you move by pushing your thumbs on a joystick. And we thought that, well, let's try something different. So that's why we did it that way. And my encouragement to people out there playing is, maybe this works for everybody, maybe it only works for a few, but give it a shot, you know, be patient, see if you can get comfortable with that.
Yeah, well, I love it.
And you'll have a great experience.
Yeah, I really love it, because it's almost effortless once you get used to it. So, yeah. And cool. Plus, you know, your music is just such a great accompaniment.
Well, thanks. So. I appreciate that. And well, also, I would say, I mean, there are very, very few VR games that give you an 8 to 10 hour experience with story and a deep gameplay experience. There are a lot of really fun, pick it up for 10 minutes, feel like it's sort of like a tech demo, play a game for, you know, 20 minutes and then put it away. You can play this game in, you know, in 20 minutes chunks, but it's going to take you, you know, 8 to 10 hours to get through the whole thing, and possibly even in more if you really come back and explore everything. So I, you know, it's sort of, okay, well, that's a lot of time in VR. You can't do it all in one sitting. I don't think anybody should do VR for 10 hours without taking the helmet off. That's really disorienting.
Yeah.
But it is a really deep experience, and I hope people, you know, take the time to figure this game out. It's worth it.
Yeah, the story is amazing. Just the whole being in that world is just, it's not like anything else. So, Marty, it's been so much fun to talk with you about this, and I really appreciate your time. And again, congratulations on your DICE Award nomination, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk, well, soon, about your new project.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks, Kate. I really enjoy being on your show.